listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Within the UN and within our governments, we are in a situation where we kind of believe that the kind of approach that Andris is taking in helping to analyze social policies is more and more needed as a result of maybe managerial cultures and result orientation and so on. Every agency and every ministry and every department and every office of UN secretariats and every UN commission under ECOSOC seems to be have an obligation to kind of feel that we have an obligation to focus on a narrow area of work and go deep. But in social policy and in policy making generally, in economic and social policy, many things are interrelated, and it's difficult to really get a lot of analytical thinking about the big picture. What is really happening if you take a bird's eye view or interministerial view, intersectoral view to things? And that's where Andris for a long time has had a lot of strengths, and we believe that the UN system needs these types of institutions also in the future. So we are here in order to encourage ourselves and other partners to continue working with Andris, and also to believe in Andris enough to be willing to finance Andris' work. That's one objective. The other objective that's very closely related to the topics discussed in the Commission for Social Development and in the, especially the discussions of post-2015 development agenda, that's not a narrow sectoral issue. It's about the big picture of where do we want to go in economic and social policies. And on that, here in the Commission for Social Development, for many years, actually decades maybe, we Nordics from Finland and other Nordic countries, we've often been saying in these meetings that we believe that we have learned some important lessons in our countries, and sometimes we even encourage other governments to learn some lessons from us. Now, interestingly, Andris is coming with a research proposal where they are saying that now in the global south, in emerging economies and other countries, several countries have now taken approaches to social policy which are not identical to the approaches we've taken in the Nordic countries, but which have credibly produced some positive results. And now the question is that what can and how can and what should we learn from these experiences? Sara will give an orientation, better orientation to these questions, but then for the Commission for Social Development and the post 2015 discussion, it's also important to discuss how do we organize these lessons learning and sharing of good practices with those countries, so that we provide a full menu of constructive, positive approaches that have worked elsewhere for countries to adapt and see what would work in their own contexts. So Sara will give about 15-20 minute orientation, and then we have invited three panelists, Clem McCarthy from the Club de Madrid, which is the network of former heads of state, Clem is a coordinator in the secretariat of a project called Shared Societies. You can tell more about it yourself. We have Michael Sichon, who is president of International Council for Social Welfare, and most of us know him also in his previous capacity as director of social security in the ILO. And we have Diane Alarcon from UN, at the moment from UNDESA, from Policy and Analysis Division. And we have asked them to give an 8 to 10 minutes commentary and further ideas and suggestions which could help Andris in developing this flagship research program, but that could also help all the rest of us in seeing what we should think about these things in the discussions about post-2015 agenda. So with this, Sarah, welcome.
Well, thank you, Timo, for a very generous introduction. And also, Timo and colleagues, Ron, and other colleagues from Finland for organizing and putting this together, as well as for very long-standing support to UNRISD in our work. I think the issue that has been introduced very eloquently is that we know in the 21st century that states, but social policies in particular, are confronted with new sets of challenges and risks. And I think the issues that this raises is that the kinds of social policies, the kinds of risks that were faced by the now advanced welfare states, etc., responded to a set of risks that did not exactly match the ones that we face in the global economy today. Some are similar, obviously, but we have the post-crisis situation or the ongoing crisis. We have new forces around demographic transitions, the nature of employment, and a lot of the social and political consequences that arise from that. And I think the issue that this raises is the extent to which the social policies that we see in different parts of the world are really able to adapt to some of these new challenges. And we know that you know, social policies and welfare regimes, welfare states that we see have evolved. If we go back historically, and I won't spend time going historically, but we know that they respond both to domestic and to the international, external challenges. And so we would expect to see some kinds of responses. But the question now, then, what I'm posing as the sort of problematic for this research is how can we construct what should social policies look like today that can deliver on some set of normative goals, whatever those normative goals we select to be, whether it's a national level or a global level, but in this new context, with these changing risks, what should social policy look like? And this might require different objectives, given a different set of risks. It might require different kinds of instruments, and they may vary according to national or local contexts. I think just to add to that, one of the things where I think we are at the moment, and particularly in this moment of reframing the post-2015 agenda, is that social policy and the development agenda, which have been relatively separate, over the last decade maybe they've started coming more closely together, but up until probably the late 90s, the literature on social policies, welfare states, welfare regimes in the North was very separate from development policy. And I'll talk a little bit more about what the implications of that are, but I think we're at a moment now when these issues are global and where we need to rethink the implications of that in terms of the social development agenda. Just because of that, I'm not going to go through all of this, but the terminology of welfare states, welfare regimes, social policy, which have a certain set of meanings and understandings in comparative welfare literature, are not necessarily what we see in a lot of the development literature. But just to emphasize when we talk about welfare states, we're talking about states that historically are quite unique in coming together with a set of institutional arrangements to allocate resources, to redistribute, to ensure the welfare of country citizens. That can be at different levels. But it really is what the state is about. It's the notion of the state. A regime, any state really has some kind of welfare regime that produces welfare more or less, different kinds of outcomes through different kinds of institutional arrangements. And then social policies is one element of this welfare regime and the collective state societal interventions to address whatever sets of social risks that can enhance people's welfare. And so social policies essentially always exist where there is some kind of state action. And they can be very varied. And they can be, I think, also implicit as well as explicit. So we can identify many kinds of policies that have important social, redistributive, or other kind of welfare outcomes that would not necessarily fit within the toolbox that sometimes we see as narrowly a social policy. I think building on that, we know enough about the current context to understand there's multiple challenges to societies, north and south, developing. And I don't really need to go through all of that context of crisis, of failures in some parts of the world. I think we're also at a time where, although social issues have come back on the agenda, particularly through the NDGs, they've actually done so in a very cautious way from our perspective, and I think I'll come back to that. We do have some good examples or successful examples, but always with caveats, where there have been developmental welfare states that have managed to achieve quite progressive advances in their social policy provisions, but also often with some other kinds of costs. But we're also seeing at this particular moment quite a significant shift in the global political economy and power balances, in the way in which lessons are shared, and which also contest some of the ways we've been doing social policy or thinking about social issues for the past decade. Within this changing context, if you like, I think there are a few things, and there may be other ones than this as well, but I think there are a few that are really fundamental sort of global and structural shifts which social policies will need to address and may need to change quite significantly in order to address them. Now, how do nation states create a sort of welfare regime that achieves its social normative goals when they have quite a constrained policy space in terms of the types of globalization, financialization, trade liberalization that's taking place? When you've got inequalities that really are more than can't be dealt just by national level redistribution, when they involve transnational, cross-border relationships. What space does the state have, and how then does social policy respond to these kinds of issues? And then global issues like climate and environmental change equally. So this also poses some challenges for contemporary social policies. So I think the key questions that are sort of at the core of our thinking are really, first, how well equipped are even the more traditional, more advanced, whatever you want to call them, welfare states to deal with these new challenges and risks? That's not the main focus of our research, but I think it's still an important question, and there's quite a lot of research going on to see how adaptations are taking place, reforms, etc. Where we're mainly concerned is how how emerging and developing economies are either adapting their existing social policies. Some of them have, relatively advanced systems. Some of them may have very minimal or marginal provisions. Or constructing new systems to address these kinds of developing challenges. And of course, if we look at the welfare literature, we know that it can often be much harder to actually reform and adapt a system unless there's some real political moment of opportunity for change, because there are so many interests always tied up in welfare reforms. And so often it may be that there's more flexibility to really address contemporary challenges in states that don't have such well-developed welfare systems. Of course, there always still are interests and politics involved, but maybe we can see different kinds of solutions to problems emerging in countries without the same kind of historical legacy that many of the welfare states have. And so I think that's the sort of set of countries that we really want to focus and look at more. And if we can see things happening in those countries, then what are the core principles, the policies, the institutional arrangements that seem to be emerging in these countries that might help to lead to better the kind of normative outcomes that we are interested in? And so, you know, the research, what we hope to do is to analyze overall the new challenges and risk structures that we currently see, and understand what social policy is or should be or could be in this context. I think at the moment, just very sketchily looking at different reforms that are taking place, I think we can probably see, and this is without a lot of in-depth study, so we've got more literature review, there are countries that are trying to more develop welfare states that are trying to hold on to what they have, maybe with marginal incremental changes in response to immediate pressures. I think we see, and this is reflected a little bit in The Economist this week, that there are countries, particularly the Nordics, who have maybe tried to reform the system but maintaining the core principles, the redistribution, solidarity, that really were the heart of their welfare state. And there are others which are responding to austerity, but also since the 80s, and the UK, my country, would be one of them, which I think have essentially pretty much abandoned those core principles to much more market principles. And at the same, so we wonder what really is left of a welfare state. There may still be provisions, but it's around a very different set of principles. But then we see, and this is where I think the research will focus and where the excitement potentially and new ideas really is coming from, is just what is happening, and Timo's already mentioned, in this range of emerging, developing, particularly some of the larger economies with growing rapidly with quite a bit of policy space, that are really innovating in different forms of welfare provision, both at the level of specific instruments, and we've seen a lot in recent years about cash transfer programs and different kinds of public works programs, different mechanisms for expanding coverage. But also where we're arguing we need to understand what forms these are taking, not just the programs, but what drives, what's the logic behind these expansions. What are the main principles that underlie it? What are the institutional arrangements that can really embed these within systems and countries? And of course, we've got other countries which still have a very residual and minimalist approach to social programs. I won't go through historical examples. I think this is just really to illustrate that there are many different ways in which welfare regimes in their different forms have taken shape. And there are some that, we hear a lot about Bismarck and Beveridge. We perhaps hear quite a lot about the different Nordic models and the developmental states of East Asia. We probably hear less about some of the experiences of, for example, African countries in the earlier 19th century, the 20th century, and immediate independence period before structural adjustment really dismantled a lot of their provisions. There are also quasi-social policies that we often forget about, which have been very important, that sort of are the functional equivalent, if you like, of social policies, like grain marketing boards that had a very important role in price stabilization and food security. So there are many examples of social policies, some of which I think have lessons, but that have been somewhat neglected or lost. Part of this, I would say, is because of the separation of thinking about social policy and development policy. I think in developing countries, and what we argue is essentially the core concern has generally been how do you harmonize social policies with economic growth or an economic definition of development. And for a period in the 80s and 90s, we really saw these as costs. We saw them as a lot of the what we think of as social policy as consumption, as a cost that should be either there should be some kind of cost recovery or user fees or a market mechanism to allocate resources. We didn't see them so much as themselves the drivers of growth, of enhanced productivity. And so, you know, that I think now, after a period of that lesson, obvious lesson being somewhat forgotten, is clearly back on the agenda. And the question now is how do we really make that real in what are countries doing to put those social policies back on the agenda as an integral part of their development, economic development agenda, and how might that be reflected, for example, in the post-2015 agenda. I think other lessons that have been neglected relate to that when we look at what actually reduced poverty in many of the countries that did reduce poverty successfully. Similarly, the productive aspect of social policy, the employment-centered kinds of policies, the redistributive solidarity-based policies that created some level of social cohesion, as well as the politics that underlie the redistributive mechanisms. So I think these are issues that obviously in undertaking research and thinking about the emergence of new welfare regimes or the new social policies, we need to understand not just the programs, the instruments, and how what impact they're having in their own terms, but really how this broader political economy, the links between the social, the economic, and the political, are playing out in different countries, and whether we can learn from them. So I think we've seen social policy definitely come back on the agenda after a period of it being rather weak, and I think we see it coming back. First of all, it came back in a pretty ameliorative sort of residual way. The safety nets agenda, the MDGs as focusing on social issues but in quite a cautious way, quite a narrow way, focusing specifically on the poor and vulnerable or particular groups, but rather separate from the drivers of the inequalities that marginalize people, and often on decontextualized social policies, programs, and instruments rather than the broader policy and institutional political environment. But I think the second strand has become more progressive, more transformative. We see that, I think, with the expansion of social protection floor, arguments for universalism in health, a greater focus on systems and institutional building, and the sort of transformative approaches, both to social protection, which you see coming out of IDS work in particular, with much more rights space, more focus on legal rights and institutions and empowerment, but still, in terms of social protection, focused on the protection function primarily. And then in the more UNRWA's view of transformative social policy, again, rights-based, institutionally embedded, but moving beyond protection and to really emphasizing these productive links, redistribution as a main function of social policy, and support for reproduction and gender, the care economy, as well as just the protective focus. That hasn't come out very clearly, but essentially those are what the UNRWA's arguments around the functions of social policy are. Now, I think in that work, we can be critical, and at this point, we're sort of looking at it and saying, how far does it take us, and where do we need to get to? Does it help us provide the map to the for these new risks and challenges? What's missing from here? I think, how do we integrate environmental risks and sustainability issues into this kind of model? Where's the sort of guidance for the links between economic and social policies, how that's going to play out in this very different economic environment, and how do we link the national, which this is very focused on the state capacity and citizenship, but what does that mean in a much more globalized world? So I think there are some real challenges to this framework that we can also look to see from the emerging economies whether they have some insights and lessons that could help us in moving beyond that point. And maybe theorizing at this point is too grand a word. I'm not sure if we can really do that. But I think we need to start thinking quite ambitiously about what kind of how do we define the functions, objectives to meet these new risks, what kind of principles underpin, what are the different kind of policies and instruments that are going to respond in different contexts to these new challenges. The linkages between the economic and the social is clearly critical, both in terms of macroeconomic and related to labour market and other issues. And the climate sustainability issues, how can we better integrate across these different kinds of risks, all of which ultimately affect people and their livelihoods and therefore become a social policy issue. There's also obviously issues around financing, which is another issue in its own right. We won't get into here, but we do have other research on that. And I think ultimately the question is, if social policy is going to really fulfill these functions, how is a social contract, what kind of social contract is going to emerge through these? And in response to, as I've already pointed out, all these major structural and global shifts that are happening. We see, and the research looks at, and I'm not going to say much about specific countries and programs, but obviously, you know, we know that whether we look at Brazil, South Africa, China, Mexico, India, and many other parts of the world, we see different forms of social policies, social programs, instruments being used and being developed. And we see both at the global development discourse, but also within those national governments, different kinds of discourses around development and around how social issues are integrated into them. And it may be that they have different logics, whether it's about poverty, whether it's increasingly about inequality, whether it's about social cohesion, whether it's about political legitimacy and maintaining social stability. You know, there are different motivations and logics behind these, but we see new things happening. And I think we also see, and this is more cautious, but we are beginning to see, I think, a sort of bigger focus again on planning as a tool, and so thinking in the longer term, getting away from very short-term political cycles, maybe. But at least the language of planning is certainly reviving in many places. And so I think we're trying to say what will the elements, and what can we see, what principles should underpin a new social policy. And again, all of this is just really reiterating some of the points I've already made about what a new social policy will have to address and adapt to. So the key issues that we want to research by looking at some of these new countries, really obviously starting with these new risks and challenges, the structure and nature of the social policies and programs that we see, the links in particular between the economic and the social policies, but also related to the politics and political economy of policy choices, what drives these. The implementation and institutionalization, obviously how do we get from design of a program to really institutionalizing so that you see the development of a social contract, an entitlement, a realization that you know, access to certain benefits by right of citizenship or residence or whatever the entitlement basis is accessible and universal to all. And what kind of outcomes do we see from different types of policies and programs? And I think the sort of issues, there are big methodological issues for some of these. We need to focus. A lot of recent research has been on programs. And I think we really need to understand what's happening at the level of countries, of national policy making, the synergies between different programs and the system. And the methodologies for looking at that are obviously going to be more ambitious and complex in many ways. I think we also need to make sure we're looking at changes over time, which obviously is also more complicated. You know, looking at, I work mainly on China, and if you look 5 years ago versus today at what happens, you will have a very different story about the development of China's welfare regime. And I think all of these countries, they're moving fast, and we have to understand. And to do that, I think you really have to understand inside the heads of some of the policymakers who are really responding very quickly and understanding these processes of change. We also need to understand the politics in terms of the alliances, whether they're class alliances, the alliances between different kinds of groups that can lead the contestations that are going on, that can lead to different kinds of outcomes and policies. And I've mentioned the other issues. So there's quite a lot to work out in terms of methodologies of how we go about doing some of this research. But I think just in conclusion, this is what we want to get at. Are we seeing emerging welfare regimes, different types of welfare regimes? What kind of social risks are being addressed? Whether or not we see the possibility or emergence of new kinds of social contracts, and whether what we're seeing offers viable social visions in the way that welfare states in Western Europe really have been the social vision for many countries, that this is where they can get to that kind of level of welfare and welfare system. Can we have a different kind of vision and pathway that can better suit economies, lower income countries in the 21st century context?
Thank you, Sarah, for a really inspiring orientation to the discussion. And now for the three panelists, I know that Michael has flight to catch, so if you allow, let's ask Michael to come in first. And maybe as a backgrounder, you've quite successfully worked for a large number of years now to develop a new concept and a new approach for social policies, the social protection floor approach, and kind of completed that work in ILO when the International Labour Conference approved the recommendation on social protection floors, nationally defined social protection floors. Now the International Network of Social Work, Social Policy, Social Action NGOs in all countries of the world, ICSW, has announced that promotion of these nationally defined social protection floors is your main issue in your campaigning, that you are campaigning for. Now, in the normative work in ILO, you kind of assume that one normative framework should work for all countries of the world, all situations. Still, all societies are very different, and some of the societies which have been successful in promoting social protection floors recently are very different from the ones from where we come from, for instance. So how do you see now in your campaigning, how do you contextualize, how do you link the global approach of social protection floors to the big variety of contexts all around the world, and how could Andre's research help you in that?
I'll be relatively brief. I have 4 points that I'd like to make. Two sort of deal with the developments and trends in welfare policies that we see. And saying welfare policies or social protection policies, that frees me from trying to define what social policies are, so I'm rather focused on what I know. And then there's one of the core outcomes in this document that we are particularly interested in, and I will mention that. And then finally, I think I make a final point why I think this actually research needs to be done from our point of view. So first of all, the trends, very briefly. There's three strands that I can see in sort of social protection policy development and welfare policy at the moment. There's one which is embodied by the Social Protection Floor Initiative, which is a lot more than just the floors. It's actually, the Social Protection Floor Recommendation is something like a charter of social protection policies. It says what are the principles that countries, list the principles that countries should follow when setting up or reforming or completing their welfare states. And that has never been done before, and there's a huge agreement. These are 19 to 20 principles ranging from universalism to rights-based benefits, to benefits defined by law, to non-discrimination, to being fiscally and financially responsible, not promising things that you can't keep. All of that has never been sort of listed in that comprehensive. So there was a wide agreement. There was a universal agreement in the International Labour Conference on this. The 6.5 pages that is really worth reading, and they're also worth reading with respect to the compromises and the foul ones and the good ones that we had to make in the process. So, but it's I think it's a unique way, and what it actually spearheads is a whole movement. We have at the same time a new social protection policy of UNICEF, a new strategy of the World Bank, a new strategy of the World Food Programme. So there is a whole movement towards having comprehensive, coherent, system-wide social protection policies. This all happens in terms of words. It didn't actually start with a crisis. It goes back to the Labour Conference in 2000, maybe earlier even, maybe to 1995, Copenhagen. It then got a new push, actually, in the G8 meeting in 2007, and then again the crisis as an accelerator of the whole process. So this is the verbal, the conceptual process. At the same time, we see the so-called new developments in the global south, and it's become very fashionable, and we've done this, we've used this excessively, saying we, or I say we means the ILO, but in my former capacity, saying this is where the innovation takes place. But if you look at the schemes, There's not that much innovation there. Basically, they're social assistance schemes that are developed that are conditional or unconditional. They've been around since the 19th century. It's not a nobody reinvented a wheel. I mean, I'm sorry to say that, but that's it's been there. And if you look at the welfare states in these countries in the south, the big money still goes to the organized social insurance schemes. This is where, if you look at a social budget of a country, there's a lot of focus on the schemes that reach out to the informal sector, but the money goes to the formal sector in terms of social budget, the overall social transfers, the overall social expenditure to GDP ratios, it's still there. So we shouldn't be fooled by the fact that there's new lip service to new schemes. The actual amount of money that goes in there is not as big as it should be. Then at the third thing that we're seeing is the impact on austerity measures, which in a way contradicts to what countries decide at the international level in the ILO and the UN. They happily agree on a set of principles and a set of objectives, and when they come home, they change their tack and say, look, we're facing austerity measures and we have to change the budget allocation to X, Y, and that. So I'm a bit in disagreement with what Sarah said, is saying it's so difficult to change the welfare state. Some of the faces of our welfare states have dramatically changed over the last 2 or 3 years. Right? Look at Ireland and others. You know what you can do to an existing welfare state just using the threat of austerity. So this is what I see in the big trend. The second point is what is actually happening in a country. And there's two things that we see happening in a country. One is there's a huge loss in many of these countries. There's a huge loss of policy space, as you said. In terms, and that is basically due to globalization, due to what you have to do in order to meet the policy matrices of the IMF. And it is perceived as, and it is probably, it is, a loss in sovereignty. And it's very clear that that is going on in some member states of the European Union. What I would challenge is that a perceived loss, or is it a convenient loss? And some of it is a convenient loss. Let me be provocative. It's a convenient loss of sovereignty, because countries are simply using this to say, look, we had to redress the welfare state anyway at some point, and in our view, and this comes in handy, right? And it's just no reason why the tax to GDP ratio that we have in Southern Europe can't be lifted up to in the medium to longer term, or the medium to 10-year future, to levels that we have in Northern Europe, which would allow them to finance their welfare state in the same way that the North does. The same applies to a lot of developing countries. There's absolutely no reason why they should hold back on investment in social protection when their neighbors with the same level of GDP per capita can do it. So there's a lot of policy in this policy space in a national at the national level, but that uses the perception that one cannot do anything about the loss in policy space on a global level. At the same time, there's grassroots movements which demand more participation in the way national social policies are shaped. And that's a major new trend, I think. And that, in a way, is contradictory. It's contradicting the macro trend. So how that actually works out on a national level is a very interesting one. So this is the concept, the things that we see. So what we are most interested in is your question, research question number 5, what is the outcome in all this? And what is it actually that we can expect in terms of levels of welfare and levels of protection? It's not just levels of welfare. I also have a little issue with Sarah and Unrist traditionally on the use of social risk, because welfare policies are not exclusively designed to combat social risk. It's not true. They're redistributive policies. We've lost sight of that. Right? They're actually changing the amount of disposable income that goes to the individual, and that was one of the explicit objectives, at least during some of the decades of the last century. So it's not just the risk part that we are addressing, but we are more and more reduced to the risk part, so which is something that one has to question at some point. But anyway, so we would like to see, is there more welfare, more protection, more social security for people coming out of it, or is it different? And if so, to what extent is it different? Is it more universal in terms of basic protection and less universal in terms of higher level protection? It may well be that. But, and then the third thing that's important is, how is that shaped in the policy choices that countries make between economic and social policy, in listening to the global community and listening to the global financial institutions and listening to their own people? How's that compromise that actually the shape of the welfare state in country X, how's that shaped? And I think we're seeing a complete, it's done now completely different from 10 years ago, when more or less the traditional demands within the traditional distributive debates within the country were fairly straightforward. Now it's much more complex. And if we can find out, you know, how that is shaped in different countries and why countries make alternative choices and what allows them to make alternative choices with respect to actually creating higher levels, whereas another country decides on a lower level, does actually Greece have the same policy space as Germany? Unlikely. What's the outcome of that? So my final point before I run off is, I think the civil society organizations, at least the coalition that we have around the social protection floor, what it needs for it for its advocacy to be a lot more credible is not just the international instruments that we have, the recommendation of the ILO, and maybe something that may come out, hopefully, out of the UN at some point in time. What we need is evidence-based, or in order to our advocacy policy become evidence-based, we need a lot more research on what is actually going on in the countries, what are the likely outcomes, and what are the new processes that are actually happening, and how can they be influenced. And that's why I said I visited Sarah years ago and said, it's much more important that UNRWA does its work than the ILO has another big project that is funded by a donor. And I think what you're doing is actually providing the knowledge base, at least for the civil society organization, that no other institution at the moment provides for this in its comprehensiveness and its depth. So I'll leave it here.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Really good remarks. I kind of felt that maybe we could ask Clem to speak now. Diana works for a UN secretariat, so maybe you could kind of then we could hear from you what from all this sounds like useful for the intergovernmental negotiations and the work you do. So what I thought was particularly interesting in the position from where Clem comes from is that he works for a secretariat of a network of former heads of state. And as I said, in this fragmented world where everyone is busy in their own silo, within governments also we only have few players who look at the big picture, and actually the heads of state are those ones who should know about a bit about everything from the from all sectors and see how it all interlinks. Clem has been coordinating a project called Shared Societies, which kind of deals with very similar issues. So Clem, welcome your remarks and advice.
I don't know that I particularly came to give advice. I saw myself as more a discussant in the role of commenting on what Sarah had said. And I was talking to Timo before we started, and we were sharing this point together that it's important to see how all the different elements of policy, not just social policy, fit together. I'm trying to name and describe the processes which are going on and how social policy is in fact a product of a whole lot of other things, and it's not a standalone thing in its own. We find that very relevant and very appropriate, and I read into the proposal that Sarah has produced is that she wants to understand the processes and the elements that which go in to make those processes, and that's something that I think is very relevant to us. Because as Timo says, our members, the president, former presidents and prime ministers, have had to kind of think, what is the overall vision of this country that we want? Whether it's a good vision or a bad vision, whether they are looking after an inclusive society or whether they're actually looking after a particular interest, they have to think about what do all the different elements of policy and what do all the different departments contribute to achieving the kind of thing that we're interested in. And of course, in the Club de Madrid, now that our members are out of office, they're much more interested in that more inclusive, broader, positive, desirable outcome rather than sexual interests, even though sometimes when they were in office, you might have accused them of being sectional. And one of the nice things that we do get is that our members quite often talk about what I didn't do right when I was in office. I'm kind of, as a discussant, jumping around a little bit, but just relating to this very much is I find very important the political dimension of, which is embedded, I think, in what Sarah and Umris is trying to do. This is all very much about a political process, and we don't spend too much time thinking about the politics of social policy, about how the different elements of politics interact and interfere with things. I think my observation of politics is that people don't change their attitudes very much. There tends to be, if you like, the hawks and the doves in any particular issue, and I think if we're talking about social policy, I'm not sure which is hawks and which is doves, but there are people who are very positive about the way that social policy can contribute to overall development goals, to all kinds of social goals, and there are those who find it as an irrelevance and they take the more minimalist approach that Sarah described earlier. I don't think those people change that much. But what I think does happen is that certain configurations of context will lead to one particular view being more strongly expressed, and of course it also gets expressed in who gets elected in a democracy, that certain attitudes and ideas will be relevant. And relating to what Michael said about the impact of the austerity, I think the big problem is it's not necessarily that people have changed their view because we're now in a crisis, an economic crisis. It's very much that people, just as you said, they have an excuse for the loss of sovereignty, they've also got an excuse for austerity. So like, for example, if you have a minimalist approach, you will now be in a much stronger position to say, oh, it's terrible, but we have to do away with all these very nice social protection ideas. So the austerity issue is not so much whether that's a rational or a rationalisation. And very often I think it's more about a rationalisation. It's an excuse or an argument for presenting things the way they are. And I think if that kind of thing can be highlighted and named, I think that's a very big service, because the rhetoric somehow is hiding that very often. It's embedded, I think, in what I'm saying, that I find that in the proposal that Sarah's making is it's very much about development. It's about social policy as an element within development. It's not about social policy as a desirable end in itself. Good social policies are desirable, but they have a much wider and a broader contribution to make, and they're also affected by much wider dimensions of development. And I think Timo said in the very first introductory comments, it's really refreshing to see this kind of sense of where does social policy fit in to a much wider framework of issues and trends and policies and activities. And the connection, for example, to the economic issue, I think, is very important. It's not just the impact of social policy on the economic, which is very important, but it's also how much are economic policies actually also social policies.
They're having a social impact and they're allowing certain things to be done in a certain way, for good or for bad.
And if we say, let's look at the policies which are produced by the Department of Social Welfare, we're not really looking at the whole range of... And I see in the proposal that Sarah's presenting this idea that we've got to look at it, the politics and also the whole range of developmental issues. I think the other thing that I feel, and I noticed she said it, the idea that there are drivers of development, there's drivers of social progress, and in thinking about this, what are those drivers? And I think this is a very timely time to be having this discussion because it relates very much, I think, to the whole post-2015 agenda. When we're thinking about what are the things that we want to see in that agenda, what are the things that we want to happen, I think a very important thing is to say, not only what are desirable things to see in there because they are good in themselves, and I think the Millennium Development Goals were of that kind. As you say, there's a certain limitation in that. The things that were laid out in the Millennium Development Goals, we wouldn't disagree that they were important things to happen. But sometimes there are other things which are more important because there are drivers which lead to the kind of things, a lot more things. And when we're thinking about what are we looking for in there? I think it's quite important to understand the processes of change and what things lead that process of change. And in a way, I think the priority theme for the Commission Social Development this week, or this 2 years actually, the one about empowerment is an example of trying to grasp that. How far is empowerment the driver of other things? Whether we agree with it or not, I think it's the right kind of way to be looking at it. It's not an end in itself, though it may be right and appropriate as an end in itself, but does it drive other things forward? If I put in my own little plug for my own organisation, which is the chair, I think we have also got our own answers to this question of what are the drivers. And for us, he described the project that I'm involved in as the Shared Societies project. I think social inclusion is a very important driver of all kinds of other benefits. If you have a socially inclusive society, you get a lot of other benefits from it. And so we have been working with colleagues, and particularly with the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung down the table from me, on trying to think about what this concept we have of a shared society where everybody can play their part, be fully responsible and fully involved, how can that interact with these other dimensions? And we have produced, with our colleagues, what we call the Global Shared Societies Agenda. Now, I think we will
come more to that in a side event that we're having this time tomorrow.
In this room tomorrow. So if you stay here for 24 hours, you can continue the debate there. But we are trying to say, what would be, and this is actually, it's called a Global Shared Societies Agenda to promote long-term inclusive and sustainable growth. It's actually mostly about economic policy. What are the economic dimensions of policy which will contribute to long-term sustainable inclusive growth? I'm going a little bit beyond what Sarah's project is saying, but it's our answer to some of the questions that I think that Sarah is posing. And we've tried to say very much, as Sarah is saying, that it's very much about a package which is a holistic view and a comprehensive view where one bit is related to the other and fits together to create a sort of a benign virtuous circle which moves things forward. If I could say one last thing, I think the other important thing in the study will be the question of what are the resistances? Where do these resistances come from? What are the obstacles that we are facing? You know, I see it as like a watch, the cogs in a watch. They're all hopefully working together and driving each other, and some are stronger drivers than others. But on the other hand, there are certain
bits of grit in the system and things which hold things up and certain interests which will try to pull against the overall interest of development, and trying to sort of see what those are and why. You know, like one of them is things like, you know, we can't do it because we can't afford it. And I think the big innovative thing that the South has done, South America has done, is that I think there was a conventional view. It was easy to say, well, it would be lovely to have social protection, but we can't afford it. It's no longer possible to say that. You know, so that, in a sense, was innovative. And the last thing I'd say, when you talk about the history, I think one of the, which relates, I think, to that a little bit, is that when we talk about the history of the North and the history of the developed world, they didn't get involved in social policy very early on, you know, and yet we're kind of very much talking about countries now at an earlier stage of development having to take responsibility for social development. Sarah's disagreeing with me, but I think we're asking more of the developing world than the developed world asked of itself originally.
Thank you very much, Clem. The one thing we Finns have been always saying, that social policy in Finland was not developed because our politicians wanted good social welfare. They wanted good economic progress, and that's why they felt they needed to develop the social policies. Now, it's very, very tempting to ask Diana. Thanks, Michael. To ask Diana also, maybe give a little bit of hints on whether any of this thinking of the drivers of social progress that may not be the things that were mentioned as objectives in the MDG framework, whether some of these drivers whether some of these lessons learned from the interesting and successful cases of the Global South could be kind of elements of something that we want to put onto the post 2015 agenda. We know that you are member of some teams that help us in drafting some of the ideas for the post 2015 agenda. So how do you see this, Diana? Thanks.
Tim, I will probably disappoint you because I'm afraid I don't have many answers. There is a lot of thinking about these issues in the post-2015 discussion, but obviously it is too early now to have more clarity on how the agenda is going to shape and how to incorporate this very rich discussion about issues of social protection and their interface with economic policies. How will they or can they figure into a global agenda? And if there is one political process here, this is it. I mean, this is a very highly charged political process. There are so many tracks right now discussing the post 2015 shaping the post 2015 agenda, that it's very difficult to say now how exactly it's going to look like and how this complexity of issues we're discussing here will be able to figure out into the agenda. What I wanted to do is share with you all a study or some snapshots of a study that we just concluded, and it's going to be published very, very soon, because it's probably it's very consistent, I think, with what Hondris is proposing. And one of the big conclusions of this study that we did, it was a 2 years review of countries' social policies in 6 countries: Malawi, Tajikistan, India, Kenya, Mexico, and Peru. One of the big conclusions of this study is we need to know much more about this. We really need to have in-depth country studies that will provide guidance into, you know, what are the issues, what are the challenges, what are the political processes that are guiding the design of these programs, what are the institutional challenges that they are facing, and so on. So let me just very briefly tell you a little bit about this project and some of the things that we found. The point of departure of this is one of the lines that Sarah had in her study as one of the objectives of the study that she's proposing. Obviously here the coverage of topics that we're proposing is much bigger than what we had here. But the point of departure of this study is to say that most reduction of income poverty in developing countries is either the result of reasonably pro-poor economic growth or social protection policies of one sort or another, with growth usually the main single factor at work, especially in low-income countries. So the big challenge here associated with the design of good social policies begins with the nature of the growth process. And if this is very central to the discussion, then the interaction between social protection and overall growth, you know, that consistency between the economic and the and social policies is very central to the discussion. And it is, we started with the idea that it is particularly crucial that social protection policy be as consistent as possible with the creation of good jobs, since this is mainly through job creation that growth contributes to poverty reduction. What are some of the findings that we had from this wide range of studies? And here we included not only emerging economies, middle-income countries, but we included countries like Malawi, Tajikistan, which are much lower income countries. From our findings, one of the things we found is that the two most important policy areas where growth and social protection are so highly correlated that they are virtually the same thing are the small farm policy, and this is very clearly the case of Malawi and Tajikistan in our country studies, and microfinance as the example of Peru showed in our case studies. There is a third area of clear interface between social protection and growth policies, which is education. And here, conditional cash transfers and the experience of so many countries with conditional cash transfers is very relevant to provide families the opportunity of keeping children to school, provided that overall returns to education are high enough to leave people out of poverty, that the returns to secondary education are particularly important, and therefore the importance of conditional cash transfers to provide this a bridge between basic education, elementary education, and secondary and higher education. It depends very much on the quality of schooling, and it will depend on whether there is discrimination in labor markets to open up opportunities for children attending school. So here again, the issue of policy coherence between social protection, education policies, labor market policies is so important. And therefore, understanding the challenges of building these bridges, building these coordination mechanisms is so important. And then the last area where growth and social protection are often looked at together is obviously the labor-intensive public works programs. And these, in our cases, in our review of countries, was illustrated by the case of India with NREGA. And we looked at, with the methodology that we used, we were able to look at the multiplier effects of an injection of income into the larger economy. And we found that those can be very large and very important in terms of providing more dynamism into local markets. So these ideas, just to illustrate how I could say, or I would invite you to consider the interest or the importance of including not just middle-income countries, not just emerging economies, but also looking at some of the challenges and some of the good experiences that are coming out of lower-income countries, because the challenges and the instruments that these countries may have may be completely different. And while the experience of emerging countries is so important, they may fall short of providing some answers to the challenges that lower-income countries are facing. And that will take me then to the issue of how to incorporate this discussion into the post-2015. And in my view, we need, and in that I echo Michael's view, that we do need a lot more evidence from countries. And in that sense, the study proposed by Andries is not only very timely, but it's going to be very critical in providing information and guidance to you know, what are the critical issues that need to be incorporated into an agenda that intends to guide or advocate for social policy and its interaction with economic policy in a post-2015 framework. And I think this will be one of the objectives, let's say, of a post-2015 agenda, isn't it? It's a tool of advocacy. I mean, it is many things, but among others, it is a tool of advocacy, and it is a guiding tool for the design of policies in countries. But then the second question that I think is going to be important in thinking about post-2015 is, being a global agenda, how does the question of social protection should figure into that agenda, and how to use it as a tool to allocate resources, to mobilize political will and financial resources and capacities, etc., for lowest income countries. And in that sense, because it is clear emerging economies will have the resources, or may potentially have the resources, do have the policy space to build more complex systems of social protection with a potentially good interaction with economic policy. It is much more challenging in lower-income countries, and in that sense, the role of development cooperation and international solidarity will be important. So how to incorporate that aspect of development into a post-2015 is going to be very critical. And you know, the understanding the challenges that lower-income countries will have will help to then guide the design of a hopefully future consistent agenda. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Diana. That was a very, very good link to the, as you said, very, very diverse, to the 2015 process, which at the moment is very diverse, involving huge numbers of people and countries in different tracks and so on. But maybe those questions you raised are kind of ones where an Andries study could inform this process, and at the end the outcomes of these various consultations will have to be brought together to some of some kind of bigger questions. Now I'd like to open the floor for comments and questions. We have maybe time for 3-4. Officially, we should finish here in 5 minutes' time, but I think we can be flexible. Maybe we have 15 minutes if we then rush quickly away. Sergei maybe has technical.
Thank you, Timo. And thank you, Sarah, for presenting it. It was really interesting to listen to, and I always enjoy this very comprehensive analysis which Andries is putting forward. I think, first of all, let me say that I believe that this is an important project, and in my view, it deserves funding because it is evidence-based project. It's oriented towards evidence-based. And in this sense, it's really important to have specific evidence on how the social policy on the ground works. I would like to make two comments. I probably could make more than two comments, but I would limit myself to two comments given that we have only 5 minutes left. I'm sorry, you are talking about crafting a new social contract, and this is one of the issues which you are mentioning, then the issue of the human rights need to be explored at a much better depth than it is simply mentioning this is a right-based approach in the social protection area as it was a couple of times. Because here there is a huge number of issues which are connected to this issue. First of all, guarantees of human rights. We all know that in a certain sense when we are talking about even social protection law, we are mentioning inevitably some guarantees which only the state can provide. And this inevitably leads us to the role of the state, what kind of state we want to have, and maybe to revisit a little bit the role of the state, because after the neoliberal sway of the 80s, the state was a kind of sometimes used as a dirty word. And then it was rediscovered that it is not so dirty, that it does quite a number of things. And Andrić did an excellent study, Visible Hands. I do remember very well from some previous time. It was Visible Hands, nice intelligence study. So what kind of visible hands today? What kind of visible hands now? How this fine balance between how the market works and how the state involves, how it is delineated. And I will limit myself to only to one more comment, and that's it. This is the role, the link between economic and social. Of course, you mentioned this at the macro level. I mean, it was in your presentation. But it deserves to be revisited. Is it economic and social like a part of one coin? Or it is somewhat different spheres? If it is different, I mean, what is the policy space for everyone? I mean, to make it a little bit clearer, you know. I think that here, when we are talking about a link between economic and social, we have to clearly understand that constituencies to which we apply or talking are completely different. So finance ministers are different from the ministers of social welfare. They have different priorities, and they obviously, I mean, even in the sense of the policy making. If we are talking to the people who would be willing to listen, we have to find additional arguments as to reinforce the idea that economic and social are basically a side of the same coin. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergei. Sergei Zelenev is Executive Director of ICSW, International Council for Social Welfare. We have Ilkka Taipale from Finland.
Yeah, dear friends, there are three models of society. First is oppression, the second is chaos, and the third is social policy. With oppression, you can put chaos in order, but with social policy, you can put even oppression in order. I take one example. I edited a book which is called 100 Social Innovations from Finland. There are 100 authors in it, so it's not my book. Prime ministers, etc., etc. Now it's printed in 15 languages, it comes in 10, but not that we do it. It was the Korean ambassador in Finland who told, I and my wife will translate it into Korean. When it came, they gave it to 700 leaders of the economics, trade, industry, and politics. In Taiwan, it came by the Minister of Education. Just now, Indian ambassador in Finland, his wife translates it. And it's it's mainly social politics, but it's equality, it's kindergarten, it's anti-corruption, very concrete issues. But we see that social policy is just now going on everywhere. When we gave it in Pakistan, it came in Urdu. We were in Marriott Hotel, as you know, it's the only safe place after explosion. All the ministers of Afghanistan and Pakistan were there. We gave the book to Afghanistan Minister of Science. After 1 week, he told, this comes in Pashto, in Afghanistan. It's not the Nordic model, but it's the equality and social policy which is needed sooner or later. If you don't want Chinese to work in China, in Japan, you need women to work. And to get women to work, you need a kindergarten, etc., etc. So I'm very satisfied what will happen. We are with Vappu, my wife, going to Central America to talk about this issue. The book came in Spanish, but also on small arms. You cannot get rid of small arms without social policy. In Harlem here, knife was called equalizer, and a pistol is everywhere an equalizer. With social policy, you get rid of pistols and knives, or you keep them, but you don't use them. So I have been very happy to listen at this thing here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ilkka. Ilkka is a member of parliament, so he definitely is somebody who needs to see the big picture, as we heard again. Then,
Anna Pushaw from Freddie Hubert, just from New York. I would just like to add one specific point which I find important. I mean, generally, I think that it is a good idea to shed more light on what is happening around the world in terms of development of social welfare systems and social security and social policy issues. A lot has been going on in many, many countries which we don't know about. Only those experts who daily work with those issues, like Michael, for example, and a few others, but not the general public. And certainly not the politicians, in government and in political parties, and in parliaments even, with some exceptions, obviously, when they have to take decisions about economic policies without regarding normally the social implications and effects. And one problem which I see in this whole debate is, and you pointed to it, that social policy is very often seen as kind of, let's say, a residual policy. We deal with, let's say, the outcomes of economic policy once our budgets are being balanced, and then we see what we do with unemployed people and all the other effects. And very often it's also defined as social assistance, a kind of band-aid given to the problems of economic development. But I think it's necessary to change this perspective on social policies, because social policies are essentially a contribution to enhance the productive base of an economy, because they help preserving people. I mean, not only technology and management is an asset, but also people are an asset. Very often they're not seen as an asset. They are seen as when people demand food or health services or education, they are seen as a drain on public finance, which they are not. Right. So we need to change this perspective on social policy, which goes much beyond the, let's say, the macroeconomic link to social policy. I think we need a change of paradigm, so to speak. And if the investigation and the research could contribute to it, it would be good.
We'll take the one last comment from here. Then I'll ask Sarah to kind of tentatively wrap up the lessons learned from this session. This is work in progress, and we hope that Andres will get busy into this work so that you can share with us along the way. But now we have a comment from here. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Julia Berger from the Baha'i International Community, and thank you also for all the comments today. I've learned a lot in the course of this session. My question is, I guess when we look at social policy, I'm wondering what is the vision of change that we have? And I'm wondering if we hold a vision in which we believe that there are really three primary actors that can, you know, through which society develops and advances, being the government, the individual, and the community. I wonder if that kind of a perspective, which perhaps we hold or maybe not, how that would influence the way that the research is conducted or the kind of frameworks that we hold, particularly the community, because I think so often the idea of the community really disappears from a lot of discourse, and of course a lot of responsibility is placed upon the state, which it should be, but I think if it's viewed in the context and in relationship with the responsibilities of individuals and then the responsibilities held by communities, that it changes the picture somewhat. So I guess I'm wondering if that also factors into the way that we understand how social policy is formulated and carried out.
So Sarah, maximum 5 minutes, then we'll have to enter
okay,
the room.
I think, first of all, let me just thank everybody for extremely valuable, helpful comments. I think both encouraging, but also, you know, pushing us in certain directions and certainly being helpful in where we can, where we should be going. I think there are some small issues that I could respond to, but generally, let me say, I think what I didn't put much emphasis on, definitely, and UNRWA's work has always had a very strong state-centric sort of view. To the extent, I think, that can be criticized and problematic, you know, it depends on an effective state, on state capacities. How do we get that? What happens when that doesn't exist? But definitely, and I didn't emphasize this here, but it's in the background paper which we're elaborating, is, you know, how should we be thinking about the changing role of the state in this to address these kind of issues? So I think that is centrally there, and how do you justify that? How do you create the capacities? But of course, not neglecting other actors. I think we have to be maybe more thoughtful than we have been to overcome the sort of state versus market. You know, we're now, I think, generally the discourse is much more about we need state, we need market. They play different roles. We need to understand how markets function, how they're socially embedded. What kinds of, when they can have positive impacts and how they should be regulated. So all of those questions, I think, do need a lot more thought. And we actually have a conference coming up in May at UNRIST on social and solidarity economy, which is also sort of trying to think what are the alternative modalities through which consumption, production, distribution are actually being organized, not necessarily by the state, but by different forms of market, community, cooperative, etc., collective relationships. So I think that, you know, it's a separate sort of issues, but I think it's not divorced from how we think about how social outcomes are going to be created in this sort of changing context. I think obviously what we want to get to, you know, we're not an operational agency, and therefore we're not about setting normative frameworks of what should be, what should the vision be. We are trying to do empirical research to understand, you know, what are countries themselves, what are their citizens, what is the relationship between citizen, community, society, the state, how are they articulating their vision for whatever they want, whether they talk about rights or not, whether they talk about, you know, however they define it, we need to understand how that's happening and why. Maybe then we can better work out how a normative post-2015 framework or rights-based agenda can interact with that and be supportive, etc. But our role really is about trying to understand what is going on and what the empirical, you know, research can tell us. I think there's so many other issues from domestic resource mobilization, you know, the resource mobilization issues, the level at which these policies are possible. You know, actually, some of the now advanced welfare states, such as Finland, did start creating welfare systems at low levels of income. Some of the countries that we now see as welfare problem sort of areas had much more developed and redistributive systems at an earlier stage in their development, and they were undermined. So I think we need to be very cautious about any kind of determinism between level of economic development, GDP, income, and the sorts of possibilities. And I think now we've also got a moment, and this relates to another program, and there's some material at the back on it, on domestic resource mobilization that we're looking at, particularly the politics of domestic resource mobilization and how bargaining takes place, how states and citizens negotiate to ensure that resources can be collected in order to be used for social development or social policy purposes. And I think, again, it's a different research area, but it's very closely linked to this. So I would like to get a copy of the 100 Social Innovations from Finland. I hope that's available in English.
In which language?
Chinese is okay too, but English would be easier. I think just in conclusion, there's a lot that we can take away here. We can definitely share with you the future directions. We are going to be very busily both moving forward on this and trying to work out which countries we would be interested, possibly, you know, could we build on some of the work that you've already done and take that further forward. Some of the countries you've looked at overlap with the ones that we looked at in our poverty and inequality report, so we've got a lot of data also on them. And we will, of course, need to be busily fundraising to actually do the empirical country research. So we look forward to any collaboration on that aspect as well. But thank you very much, and thank you, Timo, for your support and sharing of this.
Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.